Okay, Prabhupada, Bhagavad Gita as it is.
Chapter 1, text 36.
Pātame vāśayetasmān atayitānāpatayinām tasmānārāvayamantūm dhārtarāstrāṁ svabhāndavāṁ sajanam hikataṁ hatvā chukinatsyāmamādavāṁ.
Sin will overcome us if we slay such aggressors. Therefore, it is not proper for us to kill the sons of Dhritarashtra and our friends. What should we gain, O Krishna, husband of the goddess of fortune? And how could we be happy by killing our own kinsmen? Prabhupada says, according to Vedic injunctions, there are six kinds of aggressors. One is poison giver, one is sets fire to the house, one who attacks with deadly weapons, one who plunders riches, one who occupies another's land, and one who kidnaps a wife. Such aggressors are ones to be killed. Even one who plunders riches, of course, this is ancient system of jurisprudence. Such aggressors are at once to be killed. Of course, there are complexities, such as what if you claim someone stole from you and then kill them? In other words, is there any judicial procedure? And no sin is incurred by killing such aggressors. Such killing of aggressors is quite befitting for an ordinary man. But Arjuna was not an ordinary person, he was saintly by character. Therefore, he wanted to deal with them as saintliness. This kind of saintliness, however, is not for a kshatriya. Although a responsible man in the administration of the state is required to be saintly, he should not be cowardly. For example, Lord Rama was so saintly that people were anxious to live in his kingdom, Ram Raja. Lord Rama never showed any cowardice. Ravana was an aggressor against Ram because he kidnapped Ram's wife, Sita. Lord Ram gave him sufficient lessons unparalleled in the history of the world. In Arjuna's case, however, one should consider the special type of aggressors, namely his own grandfather, his own teacher, friends, sons, grandsons, etc. Because of them, Arjuna thought that he should not take the severe steps necessary against ordinary aggressors. Besides that, saintly persons are advised to forgive. Such injunctions for saintly persons are more important than any political emergency. Arjuna considered that rather than kill his own kinsmen for political reasons, it would be better to forgive them on grounds of religion and saintly behavior. He did not therefore consider such killing profitable simply for the matter of temporary bodily happiness. After all, kingdoms and pleasures derived therefrom are not permanent. So why should he risk his life and eternal salvation by killing his own kinsmen? Arjuna's addressing of Krishna as Madhava, husband of the goddess of fortune, is also significant in this connection. He wanted to point out to Krishna that as husband of the goddess of fortune, he should not have to induce Arjuna to take up a matter which would ultimately bring about misfortune. Krishna, however, never brings misfortune to anyone, to say nothing of his devotees. So Arjuna admits here these people are aggressors, atatayana, aggressors. Pāpale vāśa yedasmān, sin would overcome us. We kill these aggressors. Ataitana tataina. Tasman, therefore, narabayamantum, we should not kill Dhritarashtram, sons of Dhritarashtra, Subandhavan, our relatives. Sajanam hi katam hatva, how, by killing our own people, sukhinatsyama madhava, could we be happy, madhava? So that's Arjuna's question. Now it's interesting because there is a political situation here. There is a political situation where Dhritarashtra and company usurp the throne and so on. And so there is a type of nepotism going on here. In other words, let's say someone's in charge of a country and someone commits a crime in that country, but the governor says, well, I can't arrest or prosecute this person because it's my relative. I mean, that's not admirable. Isn't it? I mean, if someone is going to hold public office, they have to be, can't discriminate. They have to be fair to everyone. You can't say that, okay, these people are aggressors, they're usurping the throne, but I won't fight them because of my relatives. So in other words, If they weren't my relatives, I would fight them, but my relatives are above the law. So from that perspective, what Arjuna is saying is not so great. Basically saying that my relatives are above the law. They don't have to follow the law. So from that perspective, it's not so admirable. And then Arjuna says, yet yapyete napashanti lobopahata chetasaha kulakshaya kritam dosham mitvadrohe chapatakam katam na jayamasmabi papadasman yartitum kulakshaya kritam dosham prapashya virjanam. So literally this means that even if, which means even if, or literally if even, so even if they do not see, because their minds, chetasa, are overcome by greed, so simply out of greed that they're there, even if they don't see dosha, the fault, or the the fault, the mistake of causing the destruction of the family. They're not seeing that. They don't understand that it's a mistake, it's a fault. You shouldn't ruin a family. Even if they don't see it, if they don't see the degradation of fighting with friends, and even more than fighting with friends, the degradation of being an aggressor against your own friends. Even if they don't see that, how can we not know it? How is it not to be known by us? Us, who, Janardana, how can we not know it? We, who do clearly see the mistake of destroying a family. And how can that knowledge not restrain us from this sin?
Is that clear?
Huh? In other words, they don't see it, but we do see it. So if we do see it, what a mistake this is, how can that knowledge not restrain us? They don't see it, we do, and therefore we shouldn't do it. Our knowledge of this should restrain us. Kulakshayev, now Krishna Arjuna is going to go into a sociological analysis. He says, Kulakshayev, with the destruction of family, and it's more, again, this is not a nuclear family, this is an extended family. In the whole community. Right? When Arjuna says Kula, he's not talking about the mom, dad, the kids. He's talking about a large family, which may involve you know, dozens, hundreds of people. It's a whole community. I mean, families back then were like, you could say, social corporations. And it affected hereditary laws, like in England, where often there was a preference for the inheritance going to the male members because they wanted to keep the corporation intact. They wanted to keep the family intact. Because a woman is going to marry and go to the husband's family. That was the idea. So, it was tradition. Families, because they were large, these are large families involving many people. And families would preserve traditions. In those days, you see, you have to remember, in order to understand the force of Arjuna's argument, you have to really understand what families were in the pre-industrial world. For one thing, back then, in villages, where most people lived in villages, there were not social welfare agencies. actually, like, for example, if you look at 200 years ago in England, in every, let's say, region, there was, or town, or whatever, there was a squire, it was like the leading man, there was a leading family. They were expected to give charity, to actually take care of the poor people, to take care of the village. It was their responsibility. You see this very clearly in literature from that time. And the families Arjuna is talking about are royal families. These are just, although Drona was not a kshatriya. But he's talking about royal families who were responsible for preserving the culture. These were large extended families that preserved the culture. And so if you destroy a family like that, then there's all kinds of consequences. So Arjuna says, Kula Kshayam, with the destruction of family, Pranashan, Ti Kula Dharma Sanatana, the perpetual dharmas, duties, and sacred principles of families are lost. Dharmena Shte, when dharma is lost, Kulam Kritsnana Dharma Miha Bhavatyuta, then adharma, irreligion, or anti-culture, overwhelms the entire family. So you're talking about, it's not just, you're talking about a whole community of people and their kshatriyas, perhaps even a whole kingdom, people possibly losing their culture. And
weren't they already, like, irreligious on the other side?
In some ways, toward the Pandavas they were, otherwise they were performing the standard duties.
Okay.
And there's all kinds of other people involved. I mean, in a family, let's say there's a family with dozens and dozens of, or hundreds of people in the extended family, only a few of them are actually on the battlefield. What about the rest of them? You're going to sort of, decapitate an extended family.
At least that's the argument, Arjuna's giving.
I mean, the argument is to say that all the Kula Dharma, the eternal Kula Dharma, be lost, perhaps, because there may have been elders in the family who have maintained things and so on. So it's not necessarily the case that they're going to be lost. The Dharma Viva Krishna, from the prevailing of Adharma, Pradushanti Kula Sriya, the family women are polluted. Srishu Dushtasu Varshneya. Those are not protected, like teenage girls start going out in their chariots and sort of connect the dots. Stay out late at night. Srishu Dushtasu Varshneya, when the women are polluted, oh, Krishna Varshneya, Jayate Varnasankara. Then there arises, Prabhupada translates this unwanted progeny. Varna Sankara literally means varna mixing. The mixing of varnas. So the idea is that you have these purebred kshatriyas who were purebred Brahmins. It was like, interestingly, of course, now this conception would be considered inappropriate because you both just fall in love and get married and have kids and then get divorced and do things the normal way. But actually, if you think about it, horses or dogs or cows and bulls, or there is such a thing as breeding, isn't it? And they have, in America or anywhere else in the world, they have these competitions where they give prizes to these pedigree animals. And so people may be offended, think, well, you can't breed humans. But it's interesting. There's this idea that human beings are just different. You shouldn't breed humans. But back then, they thought you should breed humans. And in fact, as you know, in England, at least up until recently, they struggled with good breeding. Good breeding meant that you were raised properly, you were trained properly by your family, good breeding. So that was the idea. that the culture produced pedigree humans.
The fact that women didn't fall into the Varnashram system.
No, that's an urban legend.
Okay.
And it's not based on chauvinistic ideas.
Okay. Cool.
Actually, how could you have Varna Sankara if the women... No, that is just, there's so much ignorance going on. It's really kind of appalling. Actually, all the Dharma literatures that have all the rules like the Hindu and you know, Vedic society, yeah, it's all about the woman's a kshatriya and the man is this or that. I guess, of course, women are the Varnas. There's words for it. Brahmani, it's a woman, Brahman, kshatriya, female kshatriya, Vaishya. Shudrani. It's everywhere in the scriptures.
Someone told me that.
Yeah, someone who's deeply ignorant. Anyway, no, I'm just kind of concerned. There's so much, some people say so many things.
One Prabhupada's desires, as I have heard, maybe it's not true, was to establish Varnashram again, right? It's possible to to establish, you know, like these purebred, you know.
Well, we have the ashrams. These are the ISKCON way of ashram for people to follow them. But the Varnas, the trouble with establishing the Varnas is you can't establish them independently. In other words, how do you establish Kshatriyas in a democracy? What does it mean to establish Kshatriyas? So we have like a village riding around horses with bows and arrows and enforce the peace or something, you know, like a paramilitary. In terms of Vaishyas, Krishna says, I mean, Vaishyas do go around to cow protection. Of course, you can do that, but you know, you can't. It used to be, it's funny because cows used to be a sign of wealth. In fact, they have this common expression, the scriptures go down, cow wealth. And so the number of cows or bulls you have is a sign of your wealth. Now, it's exactly the opposite. Because of capitalistic land policies and the killing of animals, nowadays it's not wealth, it's actually a huge expense. Because the land prices, the milk prices, the price of veterinarian, animal food, everything is based on the assumption that you kill your animals. Therefore, if you don't kill your animals, basically you price yourself completely out of the market. So if you have a lot of cows nowadays, you're not going to get wealthy by having a lot of dairy cows. You're going to basically, you have to be wealthy to have the luxury of protecting cows. And that's why we have this Adopt-a-Cow program. That's just a form of subsidizing a program which on its own cannot possibly make a profit. Or it's extremely difficult to make a profit. They've got very special circumstances. So in general, cow protection nowadays is a luxury, not something that will make you wealthy. So you think about Brahmanas, also Brahmanas were independent. But how is a Brahmana be independent? Like let's say a Brahmana has a wife and a few children, which is common even back then. How can you be independent? What do? You just go and you can beg some, you know, you can teach and beg some grains or some vegetables from if you live in a large devotee community. If you don't live in a very large devotee community, you probably can't do that because no one can afford it. And then do you beg health insurance? Do you beg car insurance? Do you beg, you know, do you beg a car so your wife can take your kids to soccer practice? Or how much can you beg? How many communities in ISKCON, how many communities ISKCON can afford to subsidize a Brahmin? Whereas when people live on the land, it's very different, because then you just, again, probably everything is different. You just give a person takes them a place to live, and you give them some food, and everything's done locally in the village, and there's a little village doctor or something. So it's, if you think about it, it's not just a question of training people and designating people. It's the whole current social and economic system makes it very difficult. Basically, the Varna system, Europe had a Varna system, Europe had a hereditary caste system before the Industrial Revolution. What ended the Varna system all around the world was the Industrial Revolution, urbanization, capitalism. So how do you turn back the clock? Society should be divided into Varnas, but the Varna system, Chaturvarna, is based on a land-based economy. It assumes a land-based economy. It's based on an agrarian economy. Because in agrarian economies, life's much simpler. You can actually divide society up into four groups. Nowadays, if you want to be a teacher, you have to get a job, which means you're an employee, which means you're a shudra. So, but you're a Brahmin because you're teaching, so it's, the whole thing's a mess. Yes?
Another question in regards to the Varnas. Arjuna, you see, speaking about these purebred Varnas, but then Krishna is also mentioning that Varna depends on guna and karma.
Yes.
It's not a birth thing. So these are very opposite views. So
well, actually, though, if you look, in other words, if you look at the Bhagavatam, in practically every case, a king is the son of a king.
Yeah.
A Brahmin is the son of a Brahmin. Now, there are statements in the scriptures that there can be upward mobility or downward mobility also. In general, though, when you have conservative societies and genetic engineering organically, just by arranged marriages, you do tend to get these communities. Of course, if someone's qualified. But there's a tendency, what we don't find is, say, in the Bhagavatam, some little kid is born from a lower family, but he's real smart and just walks into an ashram and says, "Hi, I want to be a Brahmin." Although it did happen, actually. I mean, there are cases like Satyakama, there are cases in the Vedas that it was possible. But now, Prabhupada encountered a situation where the whole system really collapsed for all practical purposes, and there was no real Varna system. In India, people are designated, but it just sort of doesn't mean anything. So, you have to recreate it. So when you have to recreate a system, you have to have the freedom to recreate it. And there is, in this age also, in which there's much more emphasis on freedom, then it's appropriate. You can do the job, and you can do the job. You had like Brahmin communities, Kshatriya communities, who for centuries were breeding very carefully, so you have these like, you know, super. But that didn't always work, because like, of course, 5,000 years ago, all these demons took over the Kshatriyas. And the Brahmins also, they were always sort of like Brahmins who were just for hire, you know, rent a pundits. You know, you got the money, I'll do the yajna. So they were just like technocrats, like, you know, you could hire and fire them.
Isn't that what's going on right now in India?
Oh, it's much worse than that.
Okay.
It's not way past that.
Okay.
So, yeah, so it's, and also you get attachment. Most people are not that spiritual. I mean, look at our Sunday programs at our temples. All people come, you know, as old devotees. How many of them are, quote unquote, very spiritual? And how many of them are just completely absorbed in their material careers and families? So you get a Brahmin community, And then the Brahmins get certain prestige, and then the parents think, no, I want my kids. It's like the idea of an extended family. There's a whole status for a Brahmin family. It's not just a nuclear family. It's a whole extended family. We're the Brahmin community. We supply religious activities. We do the pujas. We teach and everything. It's like a family corporation. It's a large extended family corporation. And to let someone else in, you know, well, I'm sorry that, you know, it's my kid's going to do that. Because, well, there's only so many jobs. Like, a community can only afford to maintain so many Brahmins, and the parents are thinking, no, our child is going to do that. So there's a natural conservatism. And there's, let's look at the real world. Philosophy is one thing, but there are real world pressures. And kings usually want to hand the kingdom over to their children. Parents become very attached to children. And, you know, that's what the parents... It's like, how many parents in this world, when they pass away, take their house or property and give it to someone else's kid? Huh? Well, you know, if you're not going to give your house away to some other family, you're not going to give away the family occupation. It's like the family store. You die, you don't leave your family store to some other family. You leave it to your family. And the point is, the varnas, that's how people maintain, that's how they made a living. It wasn't just, you know, culture. It was, that's how they paid their bills. That was their status in society. I mean, all the parents ever want is to have their kids have some status. But parents go crazy if the kids don't go to college because they're not going to maintain the family status, isn't it? So psychology is psychology. Just, you know, it's the same back then as now. In Vedic culture, we call Vedic culture, yeah, I mean, it definitely, there were glorious moments and there were often periods of materialism. That's why Buddha came, because the culture became very degraded, just, you know, animal killing. And Bhagavatam is constantly talking about the materialism, about materialism in the name of Varnashram, in the name of the Varnas. It's a common theme in the Bhagavatam, that people use these Varna designations just to lord it over, just to enjoy life, you know, out of pride. I'm a Brahmin, I'm a king. You see it very clearly. You see it very clearly in the Bhagavatam. Every time there's a Swayamvara ceremony to choose a bride, Kshatriyas go crazy. You know, I mean, they're full of pride, they're violent, they're just, these are not like all, you know, some of them were Rajarshis and many of them weren't. So let's look at the real world. And the history of India is not a history of utopia. In fact, even in the Mahabharata, look at the history, there's all kinds of things. It's always going wrong. Sometimes the Brahmins, you know, sometimes the Kshatriyas kill the Brahmins. Sometimes the Brahmins kill the Kshatriyas. Yeah, so there's aggressors, there's all kinds of weird things. Someone steals someone else's wife. And these are real people. I mean, somehow or other, we have this picture that there was this utopian thing going on called Vedic culture. But if you look at the real world, it's the real world, it's the material world. So basically, the Varna system is damage control. It's just, you know, this is like the best you can do in a very crazy world. Society should be organized that way, but how you do that in industrial, post-industrial, almost exclusively urban society, good luck.
Does that mean that we have to, like, readapt the whole body?
Well, Prabhupada wanted to reestablish simple living, I think. And so there probably will be natural catastrophes. I think there's a really pretty good chance the global economy will collapse at some point. So, I mean, that's not a prophecy, it's just kind of being a conservative historian. It's just, so we'll see which way the world goes. I mean, it would be a great thing to have the Varna system, but then again, it can become oppressive, and it often did become oppressive in Indian history. And the Bhagavatam talks about that, talks about how it can become materialistic and how it can become just another bodily designation. You know? I'm a Brahmin, I'm a Kshatriya. It just becomes, you know, just a bodily pride, family attachment, very easily. It's not just this magic little system, you just set it up and then you live in utopia for all time and everyone just systematically goes back to Godhead, and it's not quite that simple.
NJV, where's my NJV?
So, we'll stop there for now on that happy, optimistic note. Well, we have Chanhari Krishna, and then just Krishna. That's the thing. We have Chanhari Krishna, and Krishna will somehow take care of the world.
Jai.